Hello, I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Reaction. Thanks for tuning in. This is a special edition of the Reaction podcast, an interview with Professor Carol Sikora, known as the Positive Professor for his optimistic views on coronavirus delivered mainly via Twitter. If you like what you hear, please do subscribe on our website, which you can find at www.reactionlife. As part of a subscription, you get access to all the great pieces on our site, a newsletter from our editor, Ian Martin, and a daily briefing from the team on the day's events. Welcome to a special edition of the Reaction podcast. I'm joined by Professor Carol Sikora. He is Chief Medical Officer of Rutherford Health, Professor of Medicine at the University of Buckingham, and an ex-director of the WHO Cancer Programme.
Thank you, Alistair.
In recent months, it's fair to say, I think, that you've become somewhat of a Twitter personality. And I don't really know how to put it, but I always think of you as the doctor chap who is optimistic about coronavirus. So, and whenever I feel uncertain, and I think I probably speak for many, not just journalists, but everyone throughout the country, I check into your Twitter to find a helpful stat or an encouraging thought or a sort of a nugget of useful information. You gave an interview to Reaction in mid-April, and that was just after the peak of the epidemic in terms of mortality. And you said, it's going to be a bumpy ride, but we're going to get through it. It's now almost the beginning of June. How much progress have we made since April? And how close are we to getting back to some semblance of normality?
So, thank you very much. I'm an eternal optimist, and that probably comes over in the Twitter. Basically, there are two extremes here. The rapid scenario, which is a happy ending, we get through this by the end of the summer. Tragically, lots of people have died. We can't go back on that, but we can get out of this fast now. Then there's the very pessimistic scenario. Know that we can't, we're going to have to live with this for more than 2 or 3 years, that we're going to have to go in and out of lockdown, some of it local, some of it national. Travel will be very difficult, and the NHS will be swamped, cancer patients will die because the services won't be available, and so on. The reality is probably in between the two, but I'd like to think more my optimistic scenario. If you look at all the countries that have now come out of lockdown, and some of them started as early as the 14th of April, that's a good 6 weeks ago, Austria, Czech Republic, Norway, and Denmark, they've had no second blip, no second wave, and they're doing very well. The schools are back to normal, the shops are open, even the hairdressers, grandmothers are cuddling their grandchildren, things that we're not doing here at the moment. We are behind in the corona timetable, but we're catching up now, and we should get moving. The British government has not shown particular skill in translating the way forward for people, and I think trust is completely gone now, and we have to get it back. And other countries, that's not the case. Switzerland, fantastic detailed timetable with scientific justification. Here, no detailed timetable. It's like it's just going along and seeing what's going to happen and then changing a bit here and there. Doesn't look great to me as an outsider. There doesn't seem to be an overarching strategy in play.
You've argued for weekly reviews of the measures rather than every 3 weeks. Do you think that's possible?
It should be. Small changes means you've got less to change and you can measure what happens with that change. You have to wait 3 weeks. Psychologically, it's damaging. You don't see much happening. And not only that, if you've screwed up and the infection's coming back because of your change, you're going to get a much bigger shift in infection and potentially deaths than if you make very small changes. So I would like to see it go fast. Everyone's being overcautious now. The only people that are not are those with an economic interest in the future. So Michael Leary of Ryanair, fantastic. He wants to get his planes off the ground again, and quite right that he should. People want to travel. They want to get back to normal. Is it safe? The only way of finding out if it's safe is to do it and see what happens.
Yeah, there's an extent, isn't there, that the precautionary principle means you actually incur greater damage in unpredictable ways. I mean, how good do you think, specifically on lockdown easing, something I find really difficult to understand is how you can manage easing restrictions with data that is necessarily already slightly out of whack and also out of time. The R is contingent on all kinds of variables that are quite difficult to understand and vary to such an extent locally and in different parts of the community that it seems like a national number seems like a mad way to proceed. But I was kind of wanted to ask what's the best data we can go on if we are going to ease restrictions?
The best data is almost certainly the infection rate, the prevalence in the community on a day-by-day basis. The trouble with that is the testing is not that great. I mean, when I say it's not that great, in no country is it great. You take a sample from a nose swab and you hope that you pick up the sample error there is variable. And sometimes it's positive when it's negative, sometimes negative when it should be positive. And you use all that data, but it's good at comparing day to day. Of course, as we were slow to get into the testing game compared to many other countries, so that as the tests improve, you find more cases. By definition, you test 1,000 people, you're going to find more cases if you only test 100 people. So always a small percentage of all those that test are positive. So as we went up to the plateau and now we've come down, you forget that we're testing so many more people now we're coming down that decrease is much more significant because we are testing a wide audience. And so as we move on now, we're coming to the end of the incidence, which is great. There are two other factors, Alistair, in this whole thing. There's how we behave has changed as a population. We've totally changed our social habits. I haven't been out to a pub. I haven't been to a social gathering for months, it seems to me. And then the virus has changed as well. So the two partners in this dance have moved around together and are changing their ways. From an evolutionary viewpoint, what does the virus actually want? It wants to hang around. It doesn't want to knock us off. It doesn't want to kill. Parasites don't want to kill their hosts. And that's probably, if you can think of the virus as a person, what the virus wants to do. And just like SARS and MERS, we're going to have the coronaviruses before this one. We're going to have to learn to live with this. But that doesn't mean we can't go back to the normal that we had before. The phrase the new normal is one I really can't stand. Let's get away from new normal. Let's go back to normal. It may take a bit longer, but I'm optimistic we'll get there this year at least.
So, yeah, I mean, I suppose you're saying that it's going to evolve to a point where it's a background thing rather than something that dominates.
Exactly. And so we'll have got used to the whole thing. You can have elaborate plans to change totally the way we live with 2 meter segregation in every sphere of life. It's not realistic. Our old university, of course, have decided not to hold lectures for the whole of the year. I think that is the wrong signal to send. And by all means, plan for that. That's the doomsday scenario. You can't open a lecture hall for a whole year. But there's another scenario which says you can probably open it in September. If without social distancing, then we'll actually get through it by September. A much wiser decision by the university, and I tweeted this, and I got a response from the vice chancellor almost instantly, was with a 2-page document of evidence explaining why they made that decision. But it's a decision that carries implications for primary schools and so on. If Cambridge University feel they can't do lectures for a year, why should my daughter, who's a primary school teacher, go back to work on Monday? And that's the sort of problem we have. You've got to do it month by month, almost day by day, to see how it all unravels. This is a swirling story, as we've seen. And let's keep swirling, let's look positively and move it forward.
You talked briefly about changes in behaviour. So what are the sort of best interventions that we can make as individuals to either contain the virus or slow its spread?
The first thing is to avoid crowds. Absolutely essential for now. Wash hands every time you go out and go in. Being on public transport, wash hands immediately you get out. sanitizers are good, but actually washing with warm water and soap for the usual 20 seconds is the best. The other single most effective medical thing you can do, if you do feel unwell, don't go out, stay at home. You know, by all means, you may get better the next day and nothing will happen. Take a couple of paracetamol, lie down, watch telly or something, don't run around. If you have a secluded garden, sit in the garden in the sun, by all means. If it does develop into a fever, just shortness of breath, cough and so on, then you have to phone 111 and start the process. But the most important thing is not to go out when ill. And that's why, you know, I'd like to see some sort of app which is being developed, but an app was not like the one we're getting, but one which is like a reverse Tinder. It emits a bleep in my phone if I pass by someone that's infected. But you know, they shouldn't be on the streets if they're infected. That's the whole secret. And so hopefully I wouldn't need to use it, but I would definitely go across the road if someone was beeping in my phone to show they were exuding viruses.
Yeah. How do you weigh those kinds of interventions with the costs of a national lockdown?
That's the problem. Lockdown's costing, I've seen various estimates, £2.5 billion a day. So that's a massive price. And we haven't heard the last of the economics of this, clearly, that it's not just the unemployment that's going to be with us for a long period of time, the bailing out of all sorts of industries, and the fact that the furloughing has created huge amounts of money that's going to have to be repaid somehow. Someone's going to have to pay for it. It's not the politicians that are going to pay it out of their pockets. There's no magic funds we can suddenly get from the World Bank or something. We're not a charity. And there's no doubt that that will cause implication for years to come. At a time when pension funds were struggling already and all sorts of other financial pressures, the people that suffer, as in all these things, they're not the rich, they're not the very poor who are probably looked after by funding. It's the sort of the bottom end of the middle class will suffer the most. They won't be able to afford houses. They won't be able to send their kids to private school if they want to do that. There's all sorts of issues now as we move forward, as we get out of this from a medical viewpoint, that will become a socio-political event. One thing that's disappointed me, Alistair, in this whole thing is the weakness of opposition in querying anything the government's done. There has been no effective opposition. And I don't even know who the Lib Dem leader is at the moment. I don't think it's a, I think it's an interim chap. Keir Starmer seems, superficially seems great, but where has he been? Has he been asleep for a month? I haven't heard much statement from him. Calling the government to account, that's what we need to see.
Yeah, I think drilling down on what I've been frustrated with is that there's been no drilling down on the rationale, the substance of what the government is doing. So what we talked about with how you measure prevalence, how you relate that to how you ease lockdown restrictions, the whole basis for that is contingent on certain assumptions about how you use the science or how you use modelling. And a lot of them strike me as slightly overstated in their, you know.
The science is nebulous behind all sorts of things. So the science behind face masks, wear or not wear, the science behind the social distancing, 1 meter versus 2 meters. And then, as you say, the calculation of the R0, it's not very scientific in reality. Everyone's got the concept. Even my small children and grandchildren understand R0 now. They can tell me about it. Yeah. But it's sort of meaningless because the measurements are so soft. The other problem is if you take 10 epidemiologists in a room and ask them what do you think is happening, they'll give you 10 different answers using the same data. In cancer medicine, if you take 10 oncologists, how will you treat this patient? 9 out of 10 would do one thing. Maybe there's one. There's always an outlier that says, no, this is what I would do here. But it's a small proportion of outliers. But epidemiologists all seem to be outliers. They're all off on a tangent to each other and they can't come to a consensus. And these are the advisors to government, I'm afraid, on this issue.
We talked briefly about testing earlier. Do you think so? A lot of the new testing capacity has come from the private sector in this country. It's quite an interesting story. They've all been now been involved much more closely with the effort. Do you feel that that energy and capacity could have been drawn on earlier on in the course of the epidemic?
Very much so, both for the two types of tests, the antigen testing, testing for the presence of virus by the polymerase chain reaction, and then the antibody testing. Both could have involved the private sector from the beginning, as they did in Germany. It was called the Dunkirk Laboratories, the idea that you'd get lots of small boats to go and collect the British forces from Dunkirk beaches, rather than rely on big cruisers to come over from the Navy. And it worked. The same strategy could have been implemented. And, you know, there's some people with very interesting ideas to just get this ramping things up to industrial scale, a million tests a day type approach. Let's do it. Let's just get an aircraft hangar somewhere, put in the gizmos and get up to a million. A lot of it is not about the science. It's about the logistics, the collection of samples, the recording, the feeding back to the customer in the end, who is the patient in the end, the result. It's just it's a binary result. It's either positive virus present or negative, no virus present. That's all you need to know. And 10-day turnarounds have been expected by Public Health England. This is not good enough. You need 24-hour time turnarounds, because if someone's positive, they have to not be allowed into the hospital area. Public Health England have really let us down on quite a lot of this, and they're very quiet. They're the sort of background people that have not made a lot of noise, and they've really not delivered. And it's the one of the weak links in the NHS at the moment, and it will be strengthened now.
Because it seems to me that the crises are sort of interconnected, like the centralized PCR testing, where you're sending off the sample, you know, it takes a while to happen, etc. You know, it's done through certain labs across the country. You've then got to make clinical decisions at very high speed, especially with vulnerable people in quite pressurized situations, potentially lots more coronavirus, you know, patients coming in. You saw, you know, lots of elderly patients who could not be kept in hospitals to check whether they had a coronavirus positive test or not, discharged back into the social care sector. And that seems to have, you know, seeded the epidemic into places where it probably didn't have to go.
But absolutely. The 24-hour turnaround in testing is the norm in healthcare. We normally get it for anything. Someone comes to an emergency room, you can get it within an hour from that. The Americans love to call it stat results, where you get them immediately. We don't have that with this PCR testing. There was no sense of urgency about it. And that's the thing that is irritating. We live in a world when we use, you know, the internet very to do everything. You use the internet to pay bills, to book an air ticket and so on. We're always doing it. So why not use it much more effectively around this to get your result delivered within? The PCR itself takes 3 hours. It can all be roboticized. You can do the little plates, little robots, whole rows of robots just doing it. All the manual grafting is gone from industrial scale PCR. When you're only looking for one thing, you're not looking for a whole range. It's not forensic PCR when you're looking for all sorts of blood markers when there's been a rape or a murder and you're comparing things to look for PCR for DNA across a range of things. This is just dead straightforward, a binary yes or no virus, specific sequence or no specific sequence. So we need to move on and get that speeded up. And it can be done at point of care now, although the variability there is enormous and the quality control is more difficult because you have a small machine, you have to have reagents which are scarce in the global supply because everyone wants PCR reagents now for this pandemic and move forward. So that's going to be the challenge as we go through this now.
How do you think the NHS will have to change to become, in a sense, COVID secure or pandemic secure? Do you see there being scoped for more of a role for strategic health authorities or more of a regional approach, or an intriguing idea that I saw the other day mooted by the group of Oxford academics, a return of fever hospitals? We had 100 years ago networks of fever hospitals across the country with specific which met specific requirements for infectious diseases. How do you think the NHS has to evolve if we're going to have, if we're going to see a pandemic-like thing come around again?
The NHS really needs to increase its capacity for healthcare. I mean, the difference between us and European systems, there's all sorts of differences, but the biggest and most obvious thing is capacity. The NHS is a ration care system. It runs at complete capacity 24/7, all days of the year. When you get winter pressures, there's no winter pressures in France. They're dealt with because the capacity is there to expand to deal with winter pressure. Here, we have to close surgery, stop operating to meet the demand of in certain winters. Some winters are worse than others for this. When elderly people go in with chest infection, they need to stay in hospital because the social care is so poor when they get out. They need to spend 2 or 3 weeks in hospital. Not so much from a medical viewpoint, but from a social and medical viewpoint. So we've got to build on that. We've got to build the capacity up. And I think the shock of the pandemic will lead to a greater interest in better healthcare systems. We've got to get rid of inefficiency. There's still too much inefficiency in there. Having said that, the fever hospital is an interesting idea, but who would want to go to an isolated area up on a hill somewhere? These places are out in the middle of nowhere. The smallpox hospitals were built for smallpox epidemics in Victorian England. And there's no doubt the nightingale with the fever hospitals that were created, big structures around ventilation support for people with low oxygen levels. Now mothballed in case it comes back at some point in the future. The problem with Nightingale hospitals, fever hospitals, is where you get the staff from. How do you suddenly staff them? You've got a shortage of doctors compared to other European countries, certainly a huge shortage of nurses, and more importantly, a shortage of healthcare assistants, the people that actually do most of the work. And they're just not around. Most of them are foreign. They come from all sorts of parts of the world, a lot of them from Asia. And we need to welcome them with open arms, but they're globally in short supply. We've really got to train people from there. And one way of doing it, which we're trying to get the concept of Buckingham, is that you take all healthcare trainees together and they stop at certain junctures. Healthcare assistant requires just 6 weeks of training. Then you move up to nurses requiring 2 or 3 years of training. A doctor, 4.5, 5 years of training and so on. And you select people as they go. But I think it would be a very exciting experiment to make all medical students, including the ones at our old college in Cambridge, to begin as a healthcare assistant for 6 weeks in a structured learning environment. And with, you know, it would teach people how real healthcare actually works. And people would get off the ladder at different points, depending on the ability, depending on the determination and ability to work hard.
You mentioned we were at the same college at Cambridge, where you mentioned earlier about putting lectures online. And you know, I was reflecting the other day about my university experience, and it was only ended about 4 or 5 years ago. Even at the moment, it's formative experience that is being basically sacrificed to get us through this. I mean, not being able to complete, it sounds like a trivial thing, not being able to complete your university experience, not to have your finals and leave with all your friends. But thousands of people will have had that experience this year. And it's not just missing out on the social side. All that builds character and it, you know, working hard, achieving something, these experiences that make you grow up. And that's the thing that's most worried me about this, is keeping children away from school and students away from university who are mostly pretty low risk from hospitalization, from severe disease, is depriving huge numbers of people of the opportunity to build up character or to have formative experiences. But yeah, I'd like to hear your reflections on that, I suppose.
Absolutely important. The benefit of a university education is that you're meeting all sorts of people as when you're a very impressionable age, and you're learning from all the experiences subliminally, and the social aspects are as important as the work aspect. It's true, lectures can easily be delivered online, and you don't need to sit in the lecture theatre. It's perhaps the least important aspect of university life. But that we were so privileged being at a delightful college that looked after us very well. The pastoral care we received was second to none. And most universities now try to do that. They provide some sort of pastoral care for their students. Some are better at it than others. Certain courses lend itself to it. And medicine, there's an awful lot of facts, and my generation of medics had to learn those facts assiduously. The current generation don't have to learn so many facts, but it always seems easier for the new guys coming along, for the old guys. So how do we move forward? I think we've got to plan that we are going to get out of this and we can return to normality, even in the hallowed vestiges of Cambridge University. I think the sad thing about this at the end is for kids that come from deprived backgrounds. They don't have laptops. They don't have the benefits of the middle class of Britain. Their parents are not hungry for them to succeed. They're not being pushed. So they just sit there watching telly all day, getting minimal education. The schools are shut. They get nothing. Some of them are on the breadline. They're not being fed properly. So that's the problem. And these people will suffer unless we get back to normal. And that's why I think it's really vital that whole educational establishment move forward, assessing carefully the situation. And that's why blanket bans like Cambridge are not the way forward. Let's do it systematically and review things carefully.
But it, in a sense, it does fit in with the history of quarantine, which is, you know, originally it was to stop ships coming to shore. But over time, there's plenty of examples throughout history where isolating people really became about isolating communities or minority groups or whatever, people who were already at the sharp end of certain social divides. And in this country, we have terrible educational divides, particularly within regions. We've got terrible health inequalities within quite small areas. It seems to me that lockdown is not particularly different to how quarantine has sort of ballooned in the past. Its costs are borne by people who are already suffering, as you pointed out. You know, the people who can't afford their children to have tutors in their spare time or to sit drilling them on ancient Greek, you know. But it doesn't seem to me that different in a sense.
Absolutely. Quarantine's interesting. It stands for 40 giorni in Italian, 40 days. And it was Venice in the 14th century, the year, in fact, that Corpus was born out of the plague. The Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, our college, was born out of the plague. Plague infested Europe. In Venice, they kept the ships riding on the roads outside the harbour for 40 days. Sanitary inspector would board, check that no one had the plague, the boat was welcome to come into the harbour. And that technique is still there today. Not 40 days, it's 14 days now. The disproportionate affecting of society is profoundly unsettling. That if anything, any stay-at-home message or stay-at-home order, if it came to that, is disproportionately going to affect poor people. And however you recompense them, people are going to lose money. I had the privilege of going on the number 18 bus down the Marylebone Road the early one morning this week. I had to get a train from Euston. And you looked at the people on the bus, which is busy at 6:30 in the morning. And these were the unseen faces of London. These are people not in the financial sector. They're not the high flyers. They're not the doctors on the whole. Some of them are healthcare workers. Some of them sweep the streets. They're on that 18 bus every day, and they've been so, because they don't turn up where they're going. They don't get paid anything. And that's the difference. I think people in salaried positions are really quite privileged throughout this sort of crisis. And I'm one of them. I mean, you know, I can't complain. But I think we have to put it in the context of society as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and just to I mean, this has been a fascinating discussion, but I just want to come quickly to, I mean, we kind of touched on it throughout, you know, what interventions work, you know, not being in close proximity with lots of other people, you know, really good hygiene, all that. What's your view on both how many people have been infected, and I can count of close friends, quite a few number of people I know who have had coronavirus, but in general, and to what extent the different rates of transmission in different parts of the country, because it seems the epidemic still seems to be relatively worse in, particularly in the Northwest. How far can that be explained by simply by lower degrees of susceptibility in, for example, London?
So basically, there are three groups of people, and only three. The first are those that are susceptible, the second are those that are actually infected, and the third are those that have recovered from infection. And we all could be categorized in one of those three groups. We have no idea how many in Britain are in any of those groups, and that's the weakness in any planning. We can guess, and you know, Oxford epidemiologists say, you know, 50% have been infected and are now recovered. Imperial epidemiologists say it's less than 10%. So people argue. The reality is that it is regional. London, presumably because it's the seething metropolis of the country, got affected first. People mixed before there was any social restraint. And now it's gone out. It's gone to Liverpool, it's gone to Newcastle, it's gone to the north part. And London's calmed down, which is a good sign. It's a healthy sign that London's calmed down in all the metrics of infection, hospitalization, and so on. So as we move forward, monitoring things is really going to be important. National level, total events, and local level to look for little hotspots. A clubber, a boy of 19, goes clubbing on a Friday night in Seoul, in down the nightclub district, and 60 people get infected because he was spewing out virus unknowingly. Now, but Korea has solved that quickly by testing, tracing, and all their other things they do well. Would it happen here? Not with the machine we've got in place at the moment, although maybe by next week we'll have something better. Who knows?
No sign of nightclubs coming back soon. What's your sense of, you know, what parts of the economy are going to open up over the next few months? Are we going to be back to the old normal sooner than we think?
I think we are. I think the pubs will open. It'll start with, well, they're already sort of trying to open in London down here. What they're doing is having a little stall outside. They sell you a beer and you sit on the tables outside. So you feel you're in a pub and they put it in a glass for you. It may be a disposable glass, but that's fine. You can pretend you're in a pub. The next step is give you real glasses. The next step, it's raining. Oh, you better come in. And then we start opening the whole thing. And then the bars are jostling, the music starts and everybody becomes happy again. Sport, you know, the Football League are opening on the 17th of June. They've just announced today. I think they're far ahead of the NHS returning to normal. I mean, they're not going to have an audience in the Football League, but they're going to be playing, and they're going to, the whole industry of sport, which of course now is a mega billion pound industry, I imagine, will get going again. So there's a huge vested interest in that. But there's a huge vested interest in getting the NHS going again for cancer and heart disease. So we just need to keep persisting.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for coming on. And thanks so much for what you do on Twitter, for sparring with Piers Morgan even occasionally, you know, for, and I genuinely, you know, in April, which was a very bleak period, and when it was very difficult to feel that there was some direction where we were going or some positive trajectory, you know, you were very helpful to me anyway. So thanks for coming on. That was Professor Carol Sikora. I will be back with a full edition of the Reaction podcast soon with the whole editorial team, where we'll digest the latest politics, economics, and cultural stuff. Do please tune in next time.